All right, everybody, we're going to get started. Here's a quick heads up. The first hour is the power hour, engine-related questions. Then the second hour, we'll move to general questions. Right now, calls are starting to come in pretty quick, but if you press 1 on your phone right now, you still have a shot of getting through. So power hour questions, we'll be doing those in the first hour. All other questions, second hour. So if you have either one of those right now, line them up, and we will get to you. So if you've got a question, a comment, a topic, whatever it might be, press 1 on your phone right now, and we will get to you. Let's get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. The list goes on and on. Today is the Power Hour. This is the show where we are joined by Pittsburgh Power, and we answer all of your questions related to engines, performance, fuel economy, modifications, troubleshooting, you name it. Call with those questions, and we'll get you an answer. And we're going to get right to it. It looks like today from Pittsburgh Power, we've got Leroy and John. Hey, guys, welcome back.
Hi, Kevin. How you
doing? What's going on, Kevin?
Good. Hey there. I was just looking through my board. I was doing other stuff. I don't see Bruce. Is he joining us today, or is he busy?
Bruce will not be joining us today.
Got it. All right. We can talk about him then.
Oh, of course.
That's what we do.
So it's been a couple weeks, actually. It's been a crazy schedule for us after the CMC, and I had finals, and I've been flying around, and so what's new and exciting over there?
We are ready to start working on the PACCAR engines now. We've got all the e-catalogs, and we're officially on board with them. We've got the we're still struggling with the link to download all the software, so we're not 100% there, but we're 99.9% there.
But we are ready.
We're ready, yeah. So we'd like to start off with
right.
We'd like to offer the same programs we offer to our ISX customers on the EGR and the after-treatment maintenance programs because, well, they use the same system, so we figured that would be a good place to start. And we'll ease our way in there. And we'll work on a damper and a balancer for that engine, and we're pretty sure our supplier for the manifolds has already got a manifold for that. So we're looking to get rolling with those as soon as possible.
And obviously diagnostics and everything, so pretty much we're official. We're going to be working on PACCARs.
That's exciting. Yeah.
Yeah.
There are more and more of them on the road, and it seems a larger percentage of PACCAR trucks are now being delivered with them, so it's something I feel we need to do for the future.
It's a pretty big change.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. Anything unusual about the damper on that engine or pretty straightforward?
Looked straightforward when we looked at the engines at the factory. One of the things that really impressed me at the factory was the simplicity of that engine. And as you know, True Genius is simple, and anyone could complicate something, but it's a pretty simple, straightforward engine, and everything looks, like it should not be an issue. I mean, we've seen it inside and out now and how the thing's put together there at the factory. So going forward, we'll be offering, full rebuilds eventually, but for right now, we're going to stick with the maintenance items.
You know, that's exciting, because when they first started talking about that engine here in the U.S. I did a lot of research on it in Europe. It's a great engine over there. People really like it. It has a great reputation. It's done really well. And I was kind of disappointed the first couple years over here. And I'm not sure what the difference was. Some of it might be just we don't have people familiar with it. They don't know how to troubleshoot it very well. So I've always believed that engine has a ton of potential. So it's exciting to see you guys now working on them.
I'm intrigued by it. It's quiet. It's smooth. It uses modern controls, but it's a pretty solid, straightforward, basic design underneath there. So I'm pretty happy about it. And I've got a good friend who works at PACCAR. So we've got some ins and we've already gotten some information, you know, for things to look at. And we're going to try to mimic the relationship that Bruce had with Cummins for so long to be able to call engineering and find something out and learn things. Through other relationships I've had in the past, I've got some of those connections already at engineering at PACCAR. So, you know, we're already had our heads a heads up on some different issues to look at and things like that. So I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah, that's a big thing. Well, congratulations. And I'm excited about it too. We'll start talking about that and we'll find some PACCAR owners.
Yeah. Bring on the PACCARs.
That's right. So what else? Anything, or do we want to get to calls? What do we want to do today?
Well, let's see. I've got a really, really sharp young engineering student here for the summer from Penn State that I've dumped a bunch of actual engineering work on, like making drawings and quantifying some of the stuff that we do. And right now we've got him applying for every possible grant that we can for our electrified axle. We're going to press forward to do our hybrid project. It's going to be a year or two down the road. I'd be kidding to say it was going to be quicker than that, but we're starting to gather some parts and we've got a plan for proof of concept and
got drawing simulations.
We actually have drawings and simulations underway. So we're pressing on with that and taking advantage of a really sharp young engineer who we've got here for the summer. So that's exciting. It's kept me a little bit busy keeping him pointed in the direction, which is neat. But
working like a dog.
Yeah, even for some simple things, finally got to do an actual drawing on my EGR soot separator that I'm working on, and we've got a nice concept on that. And I've actually finally ordered all the parts to build the prototype for that. So, so there's a lot going on here. Aside from that, we fix trucks too. So we've got the bays all full of.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
We can't forget that part. You're always fixing trucks.
Yep.
So let's go back to that electrified axle real quick. Now, is that going to be a trailer axle?
No, well, the trailer axle thing, that's already underway by a local Pittsburgh company here called Hylion. And we've worked with them, and they've actually dynoed that on our dyno, and it actually made decent power. And their testing has been really good. They've got a test loop they do here in Pittsburgh, as you know, is not flat, where they do. So they've got a really nice loop that they do, and they've seen great results fuel mileage-wise. So conceptually, it's working there. Their unit's going to be interesting, and you should all keep your eyes open for it. If you Google it, you'll find some info on it. It's interesting in that it's going to be fully autonomous. There's no connection between the driver and the powered axle under the trailer. So it's going to use GPS and all the Google Earth data on elevation and so forth to tell it when it's going uphill and downhill and when to harvest energy and when to use energy. That's kind of a really cool process. Along those same lines, and, you know, it's where kind of what sparked our ideas, we're going to do a little differently. There are some things with that design and some other designs that I personally think could maybe use a little bit of work. And so we've got a drawing made already and a fairly inexpensive way to do a proof of concept that I'd rather not completely divulge over the air.
It's top secret.
Got it.
It's top secret. I can tell you, but
that's
I have
right.
to kill you. But,
that's right.
So we're going to stick with the truck axle route for, you know, different reasons. And we feel that we'll have similar results, if not better. And so we're going to continue on with that here. Bruce has already sourced an axle for me to start playing with and cut the pieces and make into what I want. And I've got my engineer here to make drawings. And so we're looking for some stuff, you know, basically, you know, doing research and choosing batteries and motors and so forth to do it and control systems.
So,
but I really
without giving away too much, if you can you give me the basic idea of what the tractor configuration would look like with this? Are we talking about one powered axle, two powered, one running off the engine?
One powered axle. Conceptually, what I'd like to do And you hear a lot with the Nikola thing and some other stuff about a range extender. And I think they've all got the full diesel electric, I think, is putting the cart before the horse right now. I don't think that anybody's ready for that.
Yeah. Right.
That's my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong. But configuration-wise, basically, we're going to power the second of the tandems. It's also, it'll harvest energy under braking. It'll help you up a hill. It'll help you pull away from a dock or back up to a dock or get through a city and then, help you roll up and down hills as well. Is the goal. And we're looking at the motor I'm looking at is in its basic form 380 horsepower and can be more. So that's
okay.
What we'd like to use it. And the thing that I'd like to do differently than any of the other stuff that I've read about is I really feel the need to separate the motor from the axle because I don't want a very expensive permanent magnet motor attached straight to an axle that basically has no suspension. So it's, that's unsprung weight that actually gets bounced up and down on with the pavement. So we're going to have to come up with some sort of drive line between the motor and the drive wheels.
Yeah.
So it's the motor will mount in the chassis, and we're going to have some sort of super heavy-duty half shafts and some suspension back there that looks like a heavy-duty version of some race car suspension that I'm quite familiar with. So
need an NDA for all this.
So yeah, I know we should have a big verbal NDA from everybody.
For all the listeners, they need to sign this.
Yeah.
An email.
Hey, hold that thought. The music's playing. I've got to get to a break. We're going to come back. I have a couple more questions on that. Then we're going to get to some of your phone calls. So stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. I'm Kevin Rutherford. It is the Power Hour. I've got Leroy and John here with me from Pittsburgh Power. So, guys, let me see if I've kind of got this. So before you start with any of your ideas on this hybrid, this axle, the electric power, all that, you're going to start with a 6x2 configuration, right? You're going to run a drive shaft from the transmission to the first axle. Okay, great. So we know right there we've already improved fuel efficiency. I mean, that's why almost every manufacturer now has a 6x2 option because we cut down the mechanical drag and the power divider, the other differential. We don't need any of that anyway. So, but then instead of leaving an axle just sitting there carrying weight, doing nothing else, you're going to use all the technology to recover energy from braking and then use that energy in the form of electric motors to propel the vehicle again when we need it.
Precisely.
You got it.
So we pick up efficiencies in two different ways. One, already we know it works. It's, we started doing that, on the first Signature truck, and now, all the OEMs have one. So we know you pick up efficiency there. Then this idea to me is just awesome. I mean, what a great use of that axle sitting there.
Precisely. I've thought about that a lot. This has cost me a whole lot of sleep, and pretty much every shower I've taken for the last month and a half or 2 months has been thinking about ways to do this. And I think we've got a really good plan. And rarely do when I come up
we
with something like this. Yeah. That rarely does it not work. So, and it's going to be more simple than you could imagine, which is why I don't care to divulge all of it. We may pick up a little bit of weight. That's an issue to get enough battery on it. The batteries are going to be heavy. So there's a lot of that. We're going to stack the batteries basically behind the cab. You just imagine a, you know, a headache rack or one of those vertical cabinets that people bolt behind the sleeper there. So that's going to be batteries and battery cooling and everything we need there. And I'd like to work a range extension function into the maybe a PTO driven generator to help charge the batteries whenever the thing's parked. I mean, idling's a dirty word, but if we're idling under a little bit of load at a high idle, with the constant load on the engine to generate some electricity for the batteries anytime the truck's parked, I think that is not going to be that big of a deal. And that'll also work for APU too. So you're going to have plenty of power there for anything ever. You know, that's
ever. Right.
So that'll be fine.
So
and would like to interface with the ECM somehow, and we're still out on this one. Leroy and I would go back and forth with it, but you know, maybe use boost to control when we add some help from the motor, and we have plenty of tools there where we can tell it when to help the truck out or not. I can't see it not being a gain, simply because look at the crazy stuff we're doing right now. I've got an 18-speed disassembled and sent off to have some super mega high tech polishing process done on the gears and to get it back here for a quarter or maybe a half a mile to the gallon if we're lucky. And you know, that's a lot of work and effort. You know, it was a 400 pound box I sent off to my gearbox specialist in Charlotte to do something with, and you know, then he's going to send it off and have the process done on the gears. And so we're really splitting hairs, or as I put it, say around the shop here, we're polishing gears to looking for more mileage now. So we need to do something big. And once we have the proof of concept, once we have something working with a motor there and some controls and some software to work with, we've got a whole bunch of new frontiers, right? So battery technology is changing almost daily. Motor technology is changing daily. We can do different, you know, energy harvestation schemes. We could do different power gen, you know, assist schemes. We could have different programs for people who run in different parts of the country. So to get to these new frontiers, we need to do this. And I believe the hybrid approach right now is the way to do it, because one, it's a working truck that we're not going to sideline. It isn't going to have a problem. And even if this thing goes down, so now we're just a regular old 6x2 truck carrying a little extra weight around. So we're not hurt. We're not going to do anything that sidelines the truck or becomes an issue. So we'll have a rolling test bed to work with different software and different programming and different batteries and different electric motors and so forth. So we need to get the thing up and running first.
Yeah, absolutely. So speaking of batteries, have you looked at the Tesla home battery yet?
Oh, the Powerwall. I've been a fan of that since I saw the first press release of it.
Yeah, me too. In fact, the very first day I put my name in and said, I'm interested. I want you to come out to my house and install one just so I have one and I can start playing around with it. And it was supposed to be the end of last summer. And I just got an email a couple weeks ago asking if I'm still interested, and they're trying to get, you know, installers in the area and that kind of thing. But when you look at that, I think when it first came out, I did all the calculations. I think it has the same capacity as 12 Group 31 batteries, if I remember right.
That sounds about right. Yep.
I think it was 12 Group 31 batteries, a much, much smaller footprint, better footprint. Talk about mounting right real nice on the back of the cab.
Oh, and that'd be perfect. Yeah. Yep.
And your cabling, think of the cabling. I mean, here you're going to have two cables running off this thing instead of trying to jump 12 batteries together.
I thought when I first saw it, I thought a truck would be an excellent application for one. Like, just mount this on the back of the truck. Forget APUs and all that stuff. You've got it all right there. Now, I don't know how vibration resistant will be. If it's designed to be in a house, would maybe have to come up with some clever mounting to keep it, you know, from getting the crap beat out of it there.
Bubble wrap.
Yeah.
Bubble wrap. Yeah. That was,
so like
that
some
was
sort of
my
hydro
first
mount.
Thought. And I tried contacting people at the company, and I'm not getting any response from anybody over there. Because my thought, too, was Is it shock resistant? Now, obviously, Tesla knows how to make a shock resistant battery.
Yeah, there's one in every one of their cars. Yep. Yep.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, you know, a way to solve this problem would be we could go to Bose seat and have them do some sort of active suspension system for it to hang it on there on the back. Done.
Oh,
it would be fine.
Idea.
Yeah, I like that.
There you go.
Now we're thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never
right.
stop.
Yeah, that was my first thought when I saw it. Well, my first thought was trucks. Obviously, forget the generators, all that stuff. Put this battery on, come up with a couple other components, you're done. The idea of if you own the trailer, covering the top of the trailer with solar panels gives us all kinds of real estate for
yep.
collecting solar. And then, obviously, my next thought was, hell, I want one in my coach.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
I just went out and had to buy two more. I have 8 of those giant batteries in this thing. I have 6 for the house, and each one of my batteries is the size of 2 Group 31s. So my coach has got the equivalent of 16 Group 31 batteries in it.
Wow.
6 for the house and 2 for the chassis. And I just had to replace the 2 for the chassis this morning. Those things must weigh 100 pounds apiece.
Okay.
I thought I was going to kill myself getting them out of the coach and into the car.
Dude, it's lead and acid. What do you expect? That's what's in there.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're both heavy.
Yeah.
Yep.
Very heavy. Yeah. So, well, that's exciting. So, all right.
So, again,
so we've taken
up
about half the show.
Yeah. Well, that's what drives me to want to do this, that technology and the way that's rapidly changing. You know, that's something
yeah.
that we need that, you know, we need to go in this direction. It's not optional. Otherwise, we stagnate.
No, and you know what? I mean, thinking the way you're thinking and these ideas, I think we're way ahead of the curve than anything else that's really being done seriously. The whole Nikola truck, that thing is a joke. I don't know what the purpose of that thing is, but it's just kind of ridiculous, really.
Have you looked at their website lately?
Not lately.
When I looked last week,
probably.
They're claiming $2.3 billion in pre-sales.
What?
Not bad.
No way.
They're claiming, right,
come
go to their website right now. If you've got a computer in front of you, need
God.
To check this out. Yeah, and I don't know, it's $1,500, so if that's a deposit on the $375,000 truck, they say, it's going to be $375,000 to buy it.
Right.
So I don't know what the math is. How many times does the $375,000 go into $2.3 billion?
Like 3 or 4.
So a little more than that. So that means, so if you get that number, that'll tell you the number of $1,500 deposits they took. And is that how they're funding this deal? Because I don't see anything big behind them. I don't know.
Well,
I've not read anything. I can't see it. So they make a fancy website and an announcement and some cool stuff there, and then they start taking orders. And I think they're doing that to try to fund it.
And then they disappear.
Then they disappear, exactly, yeah.
And then they disappear.
I mean, hopefully,
because every number on their website is a joke. I mean, it's not even close to reality.
Right.
Oh, all right. So, yeah.
Okay.
All
right.
I've got to get to a break. We're going to come back and we're going to get to your calls. This is fun, though. Stick around. We'll be right back. Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. This is the Power Hour. I've got John and Leroy from Pittsburgh Power with me. Guys, I could talk about this kind of stuff all day. I love this, but we do have some callers that have been waiting. Maybe we just need to schedule a show where that's all we do.
Let's schedule
a show. Talk about
ideas.
Yeah.
We could just brainstorm. Yeah. And we could ask callers to call in and brainstorm, too. We could do a whole show like this.
I love that. We will do that. Let's head off to Minnesota. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. Hey, calling with a question. Let's see. I've got an 06 379. It's got an ISX in it. I've got the Fleet Air and Drop the Stacks, the weed burner. Let's see. Dampener and balancer on there, and at the CMC, I had Pittsburgh Power put on the 550 program so that I up the horsepower. And one of the things that I've noticed with it, now that I've got a little more horsepower to it, I can build up my oil temperature really easy. I can have it climb up to 240 really, really fast, and so I kind of keep my eye on it, but I'm wondering if, if I don't switch over to synthetic, if there's a couple things I can do with the ISX. I'm really, I really keep an eye on the oil quality, and so I'm just wondering if we got any suggestions other than just kind of, I try to keep my foot out of it, climbing the hills and things when I see the oil temperature climbing. But I'm just wondering if there's anything else that I might be able to kind of do to kind of help that along, or if the synthetic or something like that might be the trick.
Welcome. Yeah, some of them have one. Some of the ISXs had one oil cooler element in there. There's a big panel on the right side of the engine behind the turbo there where the oil cooler is mounted. And quite a few of them, I'm not sure if we could check via serial number or not, if you've got a single cooler, single element or a dual element. That would be the first step, is to get the dual element cooler in there.
I'd like to see how well his current one is working.
Right, and make sure yours is working well as well.
Make sure
you've got
working.
Good flow through there as well.
Yeah.
And what does the temp get to? How high does it actually get?
If I'm really kind of using it, if I'm heavy and in a hill, I can get it up. It'll come up to 235, 240 real easy. It used to climb. It used to be at that temperature before I put the Fleet Air filter on and drop the exhaust to a weed burner. That really helped it breathe a lot. And I normally drive like 53, 55,
right.
and it sits at 210, 215. But since I put the program on it, and when I'm climbing, the oil temp will kind of climb a little faster than I like.
Yeah, you'll have that. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, the oil samples and everything all look good. I don't think I'm running it to the point where things are really degrading in a bad way. But, got a lot of money in this motor on a rebuild and, just kind of want to take care of it. And I know there can be a little finicky with the oil.
Yeah, I haven't heard that on anyone else's. That's kind of strange. I kind of wonder how well your oil cooling system is working.
Right.
Especially if you had it was kind of hot before.
I personally don't have a problem with that temp number. Kevin might have to be able to chime in on this, but my experience with oils, and particularly synthetics and racing, would run them as high as 300 degrees without a problem. What you want to keep an eye on in your analysis is that, with heat, if you've got a problem, the oxidation number is going to come up, and you'll start losing base a little bit quicker if the heat's a problem. If the oxidation doesn't come up and the base doesn't drop, you're not hurting the oil at all. And if you switch to synthetic, they are definitely more resistant to temperature.
Yeah.
So get the synthetic in there and, 235. I mean, even if you saw 250, I really would not be concerned at all.
Okay.
I think I remember, and this was several years ago I did the research, I think I remember that a true synthetic or a good synthetic was stable up to 350.
Yep. Yeah, that's 300's always been the number where we'll put a warning light on a race car or something, and we'll go, and quite often our engines will run at 275 reliably, and that's at 10 tenths all the time and never ever have an issue. And that, believe it or not, I run Rotella 540 in every race car I prep. It's got the highest zinc content, and it's got a nice big base number. It works terrific.
Yep.
It's light enough. It's not draggy. Yeah, my alternatives in the automotive world, believe it or not, they've taken the zinc out of all oil because it's really, really harmful to the catalytic converters on most street cars. And again, not until the thing starts to burn oil. But the off-the-shelf oils, the zinc left them probably about 7 or 8 years ago. So my engine builder said, let's run diesel oil. I'm like, you serious? Like, yeah. He goes, put the 540 Rotella in there is the best oil that he's tested. So, you know, this is a guy who sees engines after being abused for 10,000 miles at a time. You know, he gets to see bearing wear and wear on things that are run at, you know, 7 to 10,000 RPM nonstop. So that's all I've run, and I've never had a failure in a racing engine with Rotella in it, and that's up to 300 degrees consistently. The stuff just works. So, and it's cheap.
So here's,
and you know,
here's something interesting. I have said for years, people have asked me, what about this oil? Is this oil better? How come you don't partner with an oil? And I've always said, there's one big reason I don't promote, endorse a certain oil, partner with a certain oil, because I cannot find a way to conclusively say this oil is better than this one. I just can't figure out a way. You can say, well, this oil claims that, you know, they have engines, they tore down at 1 million miles, they look new. So what? I could do that with any oil. That's not that impressive.
Right.
You know, we know that with a synthetic or a lighter weight, we can get better fuel economy, but it doesn't have to be any specific oil. You know, you have all the boutique oils, and some of them are outrageously expensive, and I've tried those, and I just kept coming back to the point of saying, I cannot say that this oil is better than this oil, and here's why. So I've always said, if I have to recommend a synthetic, just go get Rotella. It works really good. I get great oil sample results with Rotella. It's easy to find. It's inexpensive. I can't tell you that it's better than any other oil, but it's good. It works really well. So now you might have given me that one little edge that
I could give you a list of oils I've blown engines to bits on, and we never have with Rotella. So that's
maybe
one.
Not on the radio.
Not on the radio, no.
Why not? I do that kind of stuff all the time.
But my feeling is, if you're going to go to the lightweight, it has to be synthetic. You need the base number will stay up on a synthetic longer than it will on one that's not synthetic, and that base is your foam strength. You can't live without that, in my opinion. And you know they won't oxidize as quickly. And you need something with and my rules with the racing were that you need something with the most zinc that you can get in it. So as much zinc as possible, high base number, and something that doesn't oxidize easily, and you're good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, boy. So I learned something today then, too, and that may just solidify that. And by default, I was kind of recommending the right oil anyway. I was just doing it because it does perform well. It's easy to find. It's inexpensive.
It's on sale at Walmart right now for $18.95 a gallon. You can't beat it.
Oh, wow. What a promotion.
Yeah.
All right. So maybe I have to go talk to Shell then.
Yeah, that doesn't mean I'm a fan of big box stores, trust me. But, yeah, you can't beat
that
price.
No, right. Exactly. All right. So let's go to John in Minnesota. John, welcome to the program.
Hello, guys. My friend drives an 07 Peterbilt 379 with a Cat A-cert in it. He has the Rand McNally onboard recorder for logs, and it also has a code reader, and it came up with a barometric pressure sensor code. And I am just wondering, what does the barometric pressure sensor do, and in, you know, if it's high or low, what does that affect in the fuel air ratio, is what I believe it is, of the engine?
Well, simply, the barometric pressure measures altitude. So it's letting the engine know where you roughly are altitude. That way it knows roughly about how much oxygen is in the air. So if you're at high altitude, there's less oxygen, and it knows to give less fuel, because the more fuel it gives with less oxygen, the more smoke it's going to produce. So, and when it's at a lower, then it can allow more fuel. So if the barometric pressure sensor is stuck in one place or another, it might not perform well in that condition. But typically, if it throws a code, it's going to default to a number.
Okay. Thank you guys very much. That answers my question.
Thank you.
All right. Hold that thought. We're going to get right back right after this break. Stick around. We've got more stuff right around the corner. Kevin Rutherford.
I wish I had control.
Hey, John and Leroy, we're not on the air right this second. Everybody's listening to, but we're not recording.
Okay.
We've got a ton of questions today. Any way you guys could stay for a second hour?
I'm
long
cool with
necessary.
That.
That's fine. Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Go for it.
All right. We'll get started here, and I'll let everybody know. All right. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. We've got great questions today and some exciting things we're talking about. And in fact, we have so many questions that I twisted John and Leroy's arm and got them to commit to doing another hour this week so that we can get to a lot of the questions. And part of that was selfish on my part because I had two more points I wanted to make and we're running out of time. John, I want to go back to the oil thing. You know, since you've been back at Pittsburgh Power and you and I talk every week now, and one of the things I've always said is that in trucking, we don't get many opportunities to push things beyond the limit. And until you can push something beyond the limit, you don't know what the limit is. And
so that,
your background
that has been my
racing,
world for 18 years. Yeah. Yep.
Exactly. And so many times this comes up, things that I've often wondered about. I've thought, what if I could do this? But we didn't have that way of testing those kind of things. But that's what racing is. You push the limits and break the limits constantly over and over and over to get that little bit extra. And it's kind of like the oil thing. I've been struggling with that oil question for years and years and years. And here you had a case where you got to see pushing oil beyond its limit and found one that did better.
Right. The oil thing in racing is huge. And you're absolutely right with the synthetics and the lightweights. There's horsepower there, right? And the classes that I've worked in have very, very tight rules packages. So we have to look in areas where we could find a little horsepower. And you know, we were down into the zero weight stuff, and really, change it every session, to try and keep it. And we've sent some out for analysis and so forth, and the bases just go completely away. But we've blown things up, and we've usually been funded well enough by depending on who we're working with to go out and test and find out what happens, and let's go do this, and how light can we go on the oil, and should we use this or that? And there's always something coming along, and there's always. Just like the business, the parallels between that business and this business are amazing. I mean, I don't get to blow stuff up here because that's someone's living that we're going to leave all over the floor of the dyno room. So I can't do that here. But the experience I've had, I could tell you how far we can go with things pretty often. I can say, well, the 540 is fine. You don't want to go below that. So let's not go to the 040. Or 030. That's at that point, it's worth diminishing returns. But we did pick something up, from the days of running 2050 in our race cars to the days of running 540 or 530.
Yeah.
And it's free horsepower. And when we're qualifying sometimes by thousands of a second, I mean, I have qualifying oil I put in the gearbox. So we run qualifying oils in the gearbox. And things like this metal treatment on the gears, we know that was worth X amount of temperature off the gearbox. So that temperature comes from one place. That temperature only comes from burning fuel. It's the same thing. You know, for me, I turn it back into horsepower. Or in the race car, if I find some horsepower, I turn it back into downforce. You know, if I've got extra horsepower, I throw some more wing on the thing and get some more grip out of it. That's another story. But so, again, that equates to speed. And, you know, the parallels with what I did there are so close, it blows me away.
Yeah, and really, it doesn't mean that everything they do in racing is going to work over here because it's a shorter lifespan. You're willing to give up life of components to win if you have to. I get that. The physics are all the same. I mean, physics are physics. And everything we talk about when it comes to horsepower, fuel economy, all those things, they're all just physics. And that doesn't change. So it's the lessons. Once you understand the physics, you can say, well, we did this in racing. We may not do it exactly the same over here, but we learned something and the physics are the same.
Right, right. Like I said, I was looking for tenths of seconds, and now it's tenths of a mile per gallon. So the transmission we're doing, I know it works. I know that process works. I know that you know, that the treatment to the gears, I know it works. I saw it on data. I saw it on a stopwatch. So I could confidently come here and say, okay, this is how we have to do the gears. This is what we have to do with this. This is what we have to do with that. And I know where to draw the line, too, because of the failures that we've had.
That's right.
And there are things that are free horsepower and free mileage that don't cause any wear or tear, that don't have an issue, too, that you know, some people just don't know how to exploit, that I've had to.
Right.
You know, I've had a tight rule package to work within, and I've always had intense competition to work with. And, you know, we were a couple of hundredths off at Indy a few weeks ago. I was at the night before the 500, and my driver ended up finishing third. It was a competitive race. We were first, somewhere between first and fourth in every session. And, you know, that was a 30-car field, and the whole field was within a second. And so, you know, that's our world. I mean, that's what I do. And just apply the same methodology here, you know, and we could do that. And so we'll make gains, I guarantee it. We're going to go forward with everything here.
That's exciting. You know, it was the same way with tires. When wide singles came out and I did all the research and I said, look, this is just a better idea in a lot of ways. And there was a ton of pushback. People said, oh, they're horrible. They handle bad. I wouldn't have them. And I kept saying, I don't think that you know how they handle. In a typical day of driving a truck or a typical year of driving a truck, you should not be pushing that tire to its limit to know where it is. Because if you are, you're in danger of crashing. And we don't do that on the road. So I always said, I don't think we know. And then I got a chance to go out to Michelin's Proving Ground and really take trucks and push them beyond the limit of what the tire would handle. We got to put them into spins. We got to do all kinds of stuff. And by breaking the limits, I could clearly see which tire handled better, and it was the wide single every time.
I believe in that. Yeah, the tire. There's a lot of technology in tires. I'll draw on another hobby interest of mine on tires, and I'm a cyclist, not avid as I used to be or would like to be, but I could go from a 23-millimeter tire to a 25-millimeter tire on my bicycle and then go do one of my 25- or 35-mile rides. And I log data. I have an app that I use to log data on those rides, and I look at my power output and my suffer score and my heart rate and everything. I've got everything logged, right? So I come back.
Yeah.
And, well, I went to the 23-millimeter tires, and I picked up, you know, I wasn't putting out as much energy, and I dropped, you know, 10 minutes off of the time of the ride or something. I'm like, well, that was just a 23-millimeter tire. So,
but, you're talking 2 millimeters difference.
Yes, 2 millimeters. Yep. Yep.
2 millimeters. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Crazy.
So,
and then,
so yeah, tires are huge. I'm a big fan of that super single. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. One more thing that applies to physics that I just happened to see that was current was the temperatures the other day, Southern California, Arizona, down there reached 120 in some places. Planes couldn't land.
Oh,
not
enough.
Their
density.
Not enough.
Yeah, not happening.
Right. Exactly.
Right.
Planes were being diverted because. Yep.
They'd come in at like 200. Yeah, that wing wasn't efficient at that temperature. Their density wasn't enough for it. Yep.
Yeah,
that's
how the air temperature changes aerodynamics, so much so that a plane can't land.
Well, yeah, that's another one, like I said, I've always had to look at with the race cars, because when we get the bad air, they obviously we have to stack more wing on it, and then when we've got good air, we take it back off, because we're looking for, you know, the downforce number is what we're looking for. It doesn't matter what the wing angle is to get it. There is winter air and summer air. It's a fact. Yeah,
that's right.
Yep.
Well, and there's another example. One of the guys who works at AirTaps is a 747 pilot, and he has been for decades. And there's some airport in South America, maybe it's Rio de Janeiro, somewhere down there. Maybe it's in Peru. I forget where it was. But the altitude of the airport is so high that they need a really long runway for takeoffs because there's just not enough air density.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, we were just talking about air density with that guy's last question.
Exactly.
That's right.
Using an engine.
Yep.
That's a big deal.
They rely on air density. That's probably the biggest thing that they rely on is air density.
That
matters so much.
So let's squeeze in another call or two before we've got to wrap this up. Let's go to Kansas. Dan, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Very interesting show today. I have quite a few questions. I'm hoping I can squeeze them in. John, I talked to you last week about I got a 12.7 Detroit about doing the variable geometry conversion.
Yep.
And I forgot to ask you a question. It was something that I heard you talk about on a prior show, the thicker head gasket for the Detroit. And I was wondering if you could kind of go over the benefit, and you had mentioned something about how it affects the timing and compression ratio. If you could just kind of walk me through the big picture on that.
No problem. The biggest benefit from that thicker gasket is it does allow you to have a block deck. If you're doing an out of chassis on your truck, and these blocks have been around for quite a while, and I know we had a pile of them here on the shelf that were at minimum height or below minimum height, and at that point, it's junk. You're done with it. So, one, it makes up for that, so you get the deck height back, which affects the geometry of the... Yep.
John, let's hold that answer. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. We're going to pick up with Dan on the next show because I know he had some other questions as well, and I don't want to rush those. So we'll pick up there on another show, and we'll see you then. Thanks for joining us. Be safe, profitable, be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. Keep it up. All right, everybody, hang tight. We're going to do a second hour today. And I will also let you know, if you have general questions, it's possible I might hang out and do another hour of general questions as well, because looks like we might have a lot of them. So here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, getting your authority, you name it. Tonight, though, is a special edition of the Power Hour. Last night we did a Power Hour, and John and Leroy were with me, but we spent a lot of time talking about physics and cool ideas and new technology, and we didn't get to a lot of questions. So, John and Leroy, thanks for coming back again.
You're welcome, Kevin. Glad to be here.
Yep. And we're going to get right to some phone calls because we have a bunch, and We're going to schedule a fun show where we just brainstorm about cool ideas. But for now, we're going to get to some phone calls. Let's go to Kansas. Jonathan, welcome back to the Power Hour. I know. I'm sorry. We were going to start off with Dan in Kansas. Dan, welcome back to the show. I know we had some questions the other night. We ran out of time, so go ahead.
Hi, yes, thank you for getting back to me. My question is about the thicker head gasket for the Detroit 12.7 liter, what the benefits are of that conversion.
Okay, here we the biggest benefit of the thicker head gasket is it will save a block that needs to be machined below the minimum. You've only got about 6 or 7 thousandths to work with to keep that within spec. And the reason that spec is so tight is as you shorten the top of the block, you move the cam gear down closer to the bull gear. And there's a drive gear on the back of the bull gear that drives the cam and an idler that goes in between. So as you move the center line of those two gears closer together, when you reset the backlash, it turns the top gear. If you've got the bottom one locked at top dead center where it should be, and then you move the other one along, so it changes the relationship of the cam to the crankshaft, which is referred to as cam timing. So the reason that Detroit keeps that spec so close is to keep the timing on the camshaft, so the valves are opening and closing when they're supposed to be. So with the thicker gasket, it allows us to go a little bit lower on the deck height, and also it keeps the compression ratio from rising too high, which at one point, until we did some research here recently, we thought was a larger problem than it is. It turns that either with – they've modified the pistons, I believe, for the low NOx settings to get some of the compression out of the engine already. So the actual dropping the compression is not the biggest benefit of the thick gasket. What it does enable you to do, though, is have the deck machined a little bit below and still maintain – correct valve train geometry and correct compression ratio.
Okay, so on a block that has not been decked, is there some kind of a problem with the cam timing?
Not at all. Nope, don't worry about it.
Okay,
nope.
I see.
So the biggest benefit,
alrighty.
if you wanted to tweak the compression down a touch, it would be a great way to, easy way to do it, but there's no real reason to do that.
Okay.
It would be negligible, if anything.
Yeah, it would be a tiny, tiny shift. It's only 10 thousandths thicker than the standard. It's not a huge difference.
Okay.
There.
Only.
Okay. Also, I have a quick comment about the ISX. You had a caller earlier on another show that was running high oil temperature. I've had the painful experience of owning five ISXs, three CM870s and two CM871s. They all ran 235 oil temperature pretty often. I pull the Rockies fairly often, and with a heavy load on a warm day, 245, 250, bells and whistles going off, and that was on three different trucks, and I've got a couple of buddies with ISXs. They all experienced the same thing. I don't know about the newer models, but the CM870, CM871, they all seem to run high oil temperature. Now, all of my trucks were single element oil coolers, so that may have a bearing on you know, how hot that oil gets, but I just wanted to give you that feedback on that. And also, one quick question before I go. I've got a 69 Dodge Charger. John, would you recommend that Rotella 540 oil in that vehicle?
Absolutely. My father's got a 67 big block Corvette with 427, 435 in it.
Oh, wow.
We've been running Rotella 540 in it for years. Yep. Yeah, a lot of the muscle car guys, if you go on some of the message boards and read about oils, a lot of them are running the diesel oils. It's kind of making its way around. People are starting to figure it out.
Good place for info.
Okay.
Yep.
And it's the zinc that it's an added, it's a lubricant. Is that correct?
Yes. The zinc is kind of your first and last line of defense. If for some reason you were to lose oil pressure due to, you know, going around a turn or slosh or something, the zinc is the last barrier. It's the last thing that helps you out, as well as a cold start. The zinc seems to stay behind when the oil falls off or when everything drains back down into the crankcase after you sit there. So it's your first and last line of defense, and the older engines seem to need it. The flat tappet cams need the zinc. It's a nice barrier between the cam and the lifters. There are a lot of benefits to having zinc in the oil. There are a lot of additives out there that I'm not a big fan of. I don't know how they stay in suspension or how they could possibly stay in suspension personally and be everywhere like they should be.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. It's better that it's already blended that way.
It's already blended that way and it stays that way. So that,
right. Doesn't make it unstable.
So I highly recommend it. Or if you're not going to use the diesel oil, spend the money and use a racing oil of some sort. The Brad Penn stuff's terrific. The green oil, that's actually a copy of the old Kendall GT1. It's loaded with zinc, too. But again, you're going to spend as much money for a quart of that as you spend for a gallon of Rotella, and the Rotella is just as good, if not better. In fact, I think I believe the Rotella is a little slicker and it's lighter weight, and it's good for horsepower as well.
They're going to send you a free jug.
That'd be cool. They can send you a free jug they want. I put it in everything, so that's no problem. Yeah,
that's right.
Hey, one more quick question, if I could. While we're talking about oil, I change my own oil on my Detroit. Sometimes I let it drain for a couple hours while I'm working on other things on the truck, just to get all that old black stuff out of the engine. And I've noticed it takes a little longer for the oil pressure to build back after I refill it and start the engine. What would you recommend? Let it drain for a couple hours or not?
I don't have a problem with that at all. I'd rather get that out of there. But what's happening is you're draining the whole pickup tube inside of there, and it's got to take a little while for it to pick back up. So I don't know if there's a way to crank that engine without it starting. Is there a wire I could pull off or do something to make it?
You mean just by turning the starter?
Yeah, is there a way you could crank it and have it not start?
Have it not start? You could pull the two injector clips off the back of the ECM.
Yeah.
You just pop the two injector plugs off, and then you can...
Yeah, if that concerns you, I'd rather get that oil out of there myself. I agree with you on that. But if you're worried about it starting too quickly or taking a while to build oil pressure after it starts, now keep in mind that's an instance right there where the zinc in the oil is keeping you from hurting things.
That's
one of those.
You don't even need to do that. Just jump a hot wire over the starter.
Well, you'd have to jump a hot wire to the starter.
The ECM wouldn't see the key switch, so it wouldn't fire.
Right. Yeah, often with that, a lot of engines I've worked with, we'll purposely crank them before we start them. We'll have a separate... separate kill switch that we could use, so we could crank up the oil which starts.
I've got a Maxwell start module, so I can do that no problem.
Oh, you got about 30 seconds, and then you got to wait again. So yeah, be careful with that.
Oh yeah,
You got it. Yeah, you drain that capacitor, then you're waiting for it to charge up again.
Yeah, we've done the crank test, though. With a good set of batteries, even the start module will give you five or six before you have to wait.
Well, okay, good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, when we do the crank test on that, that's exactly what we do. I had a thought there. What was it? Jog my memory. What all did he talk about? Because while he was talking about, I had a question or something I wanted to say.
Let's see. 69 charge.
We're talking about. Draining,
draining
the oil
for a long time. Yep.
I don't think it was that. You talked about using the Rotella. Darn, I had something. Well, I'll get to another question. Maybe it'll come back to me. Let's go to Kansas. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. I just have a quick question about a manifold. I wanted to purchase that manifold for my truck. I have a Cat Acer 2006. And I wanted to know, what is the difference between Pittsburgh Power Manifold and PDI Manifold? Is it the same thing, same manifold, or is it a little different?
I can't answer that. I personally have zero experience with the PDI Manifold, so I can't answer that for you.
Okay.
Yeah,
but
I don't have any idea.
I'll plead ignorance on that one.
Yeah, the guys over at PDI don't seem to like me, so I don't know why that is.
So
I don't know anything.
Is better. That's all. That's all I know.
Right.
It's better.
That's what I've always said. Hold that thought. We're going to get to a break, and I did remember what I wanted to say. So we're going to come back and talk about that in just a second, and we're going to get to more of your calls and questions. Stick around, I'm Kevin Rutherford. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. I'm Kevin Routsford. The website is letstruck.com. This is the Power Hour. I've got John and Leroy from Pittsburgh Power. So, hey, guys, I remembered what I wanted to talk about. You were talking about how important zinc is in the oil. Absolutely. First line of defense, last line of defense. And it's one of the many, many reasons I'm so big on oil samples in trucks. It doesn't take a whole lot of coolant to strip the zinc out of the oil. That's one of the big problems when coolant gets in. It strips the zinc out, and then we lose that protection. And it's easy to have a small coolant leak getting into the oil and not know it for a long time. So I'm glad, John, you brought up how important zinc is.
You just taught me something right there. Thanks for that info.
Yeah, coolant, but that's the first damage it causes.
Yeah.
Somehow it strips the zinc out. Yeah.
This is a two-way conversation.
How about that? Yep.
Yeah, there you go.
Cool.
There you go.
Thank you.
So you're welcome. I owe you a ton, so I'll try to catch up.
No, we owe you a ton.
Yep.
Let's
Hey, when
let's
we get
go
when,
to Georgia.
When's that RV coming
hold
over?
On.
Okay.
You know, I was hoping that question wasn't going to come up.
I knew Bruce, Bruce would have asked it by now. I just channeled my inner Bruce right there for a second.
I know. See, I was actually just a little excited that Bruce wasn't going to be here this week. I knew he was going to give me a hard time. We're right here, but our schedule is so swamped. Yeah, I don't think we're going to make it over there. I know.
We see how you are.
Okay. Okay. I appreciate you guys being ready and waiting, and I just don't think I'm going to be able to make it work. So we'll see. We'll see. Let's go to Georgia. Steve, welcome to the program. Yeah, there you go.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. And I just had a general question, a two-part question. I got a DD15 in a Cascadia, and I had to take it in to have a little tip put on the pickup tube in the oil pan, and had to have my oil pan seals changed. And the question I was having is that when I take my next sample, oil sample, what should I expect in that next oil sample by doing that?
I wouldn't think anything would change.
Now,
so this is the second time I've heard of this problem. There was a fellow, we've got one in the shop right now that we've got the pan down on. We actually had to reseal the rear structure, which was interesting. I really like that engine. I think that's a neat piece, that DD15. But there are a lot of O-rings and tubes and oil pickup stuff in there, and it's recommended that you change the O-rings on those, too. I hope they did that while you had that apart, because it could suck air, so it'll pull air into the oil system there, so you'd see that in your oil pressure. But I can't imagine there being any issue with your oil sample or seeing anything different.
Unless they got a bunch of dirt in there when they were working on it.
Yeah, unless you didn't have the cleanest mechanics working on it.
They were animals.
Right. Yeah, right.
Okay, I do appreciate it. My oil pressure was fluctuating just like my RPM needle was, and at some point it will, whenever I first take off, the oil pressure light will come on, and so that's the reason why I had it done, and I do appreciate you taking my call.
Yeah, evidently
they
resealed those O-rings on the pickup tubes inside the pan. There's there have to be at least 8 O-rings in that whole system there, and if one of those starts pulling some air, yep, it's an intricate piece. It's interesting. It's a neat engine.
Yeah, well, I love the engine. I didn't realize that though. That's pretty wild. Let's go to Iowa. Randy, welcome to the program.
Hi, guys. Have you guys ever done any experiment with switching to, like, say I got a 2010 truck and switch into a pre-emission engine and something like that?
Let me jump in, John, before you guys do on this, because I seem to be getting this question a lot lately. Yeah, I'll tell you my answer on this. One, it's illegal, and nobody's really checking that kind of stuff right now and enforcing it, but that's a big investment to run the risk of somebody shutting down that truck because it's non-compliant. And I just don't see any reason to take that kind of risk. Two,
Amen.
John, this is where you guys can probably jump in. I don't think this is a simple switch.
No, not at all.
It wasn't simple. We did it. But I was just curious if you guys had ever done that before.
I think they probably have in the past.
No, not since I've been here, that's for sure.
Yeah, not
in, yeah.
I see.
In my opinion, it's just not worth it for a lot of reasons. There's just so many other ways to come up with the same result that are a lot cheaper and don't have any negative consequences of somebody making that truck not compliant.
It had over 1,000,000 miles on the existing engine. I had to either overhaul it or stick a crate engine in it. It had a broken head. So I was to the point where the truck is too good a shape to just get rid of it, so I decided to go that route, and I stuck a crate engine in from Cummins, an old one.
So who did the work? I guess what I'm asking for, I don't really care who did it. I'm wondering what a true overall cost ended up being by the time you got it done and got it running again.
Well, I haven't gotten the bill. It's just been a couple weeks ago, but it's my guess is going to be around $37,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'll tell you, the other one, the way this one runs compared to the other one is it's way better.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I get that. When you have one of the emission engines not running right, they just suck. I mean, I get that. I keep getting this question a lot, and my answer is I just wouldn't do it. I think it's too expensive, and there's too much risk in having a non-compliant truck. So, but you've got
there
it
other...
if it runs right. Good luck.
You know, there are other drawbacks as well. You pull into some shops, and they'll actually ask you to leave. So it's tough. I don't recommend it. And we've got all that stuff working so well now. I don't see it's not as problematic as it was. I mean, those systems were obviously rushed to market. You know, the government mandated it, the manufacturers weren't ready, they rushed some stuff to market that wasn't there. You know, the stuff you buy now, like this DD15 I've got in the shop, the guy's never had a check engine light. It's got 600,000 miles on it, and you know, it's just it they've got it figured out. I mean, it's a lot better, and we've got it figured out too. We've learned how to tune around that stuff and how to maybe even fine-tune some of that stuff, and it just works. I mean, it just works now. So,
you know, I think the second part of that, John, is more important than the first. I agree that they've got most of the engineering worked out. I think the problems are coming in afterwards when things break, and things are going to break. I mean, it's mechanical. Something's going to go wrong. I think the problem we're still facing is that you can throw so much money at these things and time and pull out of the shop, and it's so common to have the same problem again. And that's what
frustrates
me. Let's
let Leroy. Leroy could tell you a story about the CMC. There was a fellow at the CMC who went over to the Peterbilt dealership next door, and Leroy told him what they were going to tell him when he went over. So you could tell him that story.
Oh, yeah.
Remember?
Yeah, what was his name?
This happens every time. Ken.
Yeah, he came to me in the booth, and he says, I have a check engine light. He told me exactly what check engine light it was, which was pretty cool. So he tells me exactly what check engine light it is. So I sit down with him, and I go right to Cummins, right what the techs would use. And I said, they're going to go through this troubleshooting tree, and they're going to want to put an SCR on your truck. I said, they just need to tear the decomp tube down, take the doser out. It's probably just, like, crystallized in there, and it probably just needs cleaned out. I was like, you know, couple hours, 2 or 3 hours, and then you're going to be on your way. Maybe a couple gases, too.
Yep.
So he goes over there, and they're 8 hours into it, and they tell him that it won't regen properly, that he needs an SCR. And he called me back and he said, yeah, you were right. And then he called them back and told them, no, just clean this part out. And they're like, no, you need an SCR. But somehow he talked them into cleaning out that e-comp tube, and his truck's out there just running just fine. So
there's check engine lights quite often lead to people treating the symptoms and not the causes, is what I've learned here
exactly.
in my time here watching this. And
exactly. I have one better than that, actually.
Still with the new trucks. Go ahead.
Right.
I had one just the other day. I don't know if you remember this one. He came in the back parking lot, and some other shop, there's a CM870. They put an EGR valve on it, and I don't remember what else. And I walked up to it, and it just needed a pressure sensor. I fixed it in the parking lot in 10 minutes and sent him on his way after he already spent $2,000 on EGR valve and everything. It's crazy.
Yeah. See, if we could get every new truck problem, I don't care about the whole country. I only care about my listeners. If I could get every one of my listeners to take all of their new truck problems to you guys, I'd be okay with new trucks. You might have to have 250 more employees, but, you know, you'd have to figure that out. We'll be right back. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. I've got John and Leroy with me. So just so you guys know, when I get these frustrating, you know, new emission truck questions, and I absolutely can't send anybody to the shop and say, well, they're just going to fix it, because that's not the case. It's almost more often that they don't. So I just recorded this little piece where I talk about you guys, and I just hit the button when somebody asks that question, and I can go get a snack or something.
Yeah,
perfect.
That's right. Yeah,
that's using your head, Kevin. That's
8 or 9 times out of 10, it's going to be a sensor or something, a crossover tube that reads that sensor. 8 or 9 times out of 10, that's what it is.
Or sometimes
wow.
that sensor
you
leads to another problem. Yeah, they're really more reliable than you want to think. The problem is that everybody had to go from nothing to something, right? So even if these things only need to be looked at every 250,000 miles, well, you didn't have to do that before. So it is kind of a pain in the ass, I realize. But the stuff does work. The trucks are getting decent fuel mileage now. And again, it's, you know, we've got to learn to embrace it. And from a business standpoint for us, we're better off working on it. You know, that's good business for us. That's one of the reasons I want to take on the PACCAR thing.
Yeah.
And I want to start the after-treatment system maintenance and the EGR maintenance, because we've got it down. Got
to keep them on the road.
I've got, total confidence in these guys here, and we've got a good team, and I think we're more on top of it than anybody I've talked to. I don't know anyone that I've met so far in the industry that has the understanding. They just look at the check engine lights and throw parts at it. And,
exactly.
Yeah, next thing you know, the guys.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
we don't do that. I've been saying for almost a decade, we will solve all of these problems. We did it with cars. We went through this in the 70s. That was a nightmare. Cars were horrible back then. Now, my God, cars run forever anymore. You hardly have to do anything to them. And we'll get there with trucks. We'll figure out all this technology. It'll all work great. We'll get back great fuel economy. We're just not there. It was one thing to have a car that was a pain in the ass to fix or not running right. But it's another when it's your livelihood, when this is your business and the truck's always in the shop and people can't fix it. That's just too much of a risk for me right now.
I have to tell you, coming back, you know, being intimate with the business again after X amount of years, in the 80s and 90s, early 90s when I worked in the old shop, we were rebuilding Big Cam Cummins like every 350,000 miles. We're lucky if one went to a half million miles.
Yeah.
And these guys are bummed out about having to maintain their EGR system at 250. It amazes me how much better they've gotten in that block of time. It was a real eye-opener. I mean, everything's expected now to go a million miles. If it doesn't, it's a real big problem. Like, holy crap. Like that. I can't believe it. And the industry has changed and technology has changed. And, you know, it's the electronics that enable that, the management systems, and they're so much cleaner, and their cylinders aren't being washed down by diesel fuel anymore. And there's a whole lot of things that are better. It blows me away.
But here's my problem. The fact that you have to maintain that emission system every 250,000 miles does bother me at all. In fact, I'd love that. Finally, here's something that might work. So that I love. What I don't like is the unpredictable nature of the problems. The truck, I mean, you don't know what to fix. It's running down the road. It's going just fine. And then it derates and you're on the side of the road. I mean, that didn't happen a whole lot prior to these emission trucks. Mechanical engines didn't do that very often. The first electronics certainly didn't do it. I'm okay with the additional cost, with some upkeep. I don't mind that. It's being on the side of the road, then getting towed to a shop, then the shop throwing a bunch of money at it, me being down for 2 or 3 days, and then I pull out and 40 miles later I have the same problem. We never
because they missed the sensor that was causing the problem. Yep.
Right. Yep. That's my problem, is that we can't. Or I had a guy had an SCR problem, I think, the other day. $10,000. They had to replace the SCR system on the truck. $10,000.
I almost guarantee you that didn't have to be completely replaced. I would be willing, from the things I've seen here.
Right. Yep. I know. But what is somebody supposed to do? Like I said, if I could get all my listeners to come to you guys every time, I'd feel better about these things.
Well, I think we need to go for it. Yeah, if we have to put those employees on or open up some branches or whatever, I think we need to push on with all of that.
All right. There we go. Let's go to Maryland. Tad, welcome to the program.
Well, hello, Kevin, John, Leroy. How we doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, Kevin, I talked to you Sunday. My first question, I got a comment and I got a question. You told me to call back and they would get a better idea. I just want to bring you up to speed on my truck, John. I got the DD15, 2014. I love my emission truck. I know nobody likes them, but either I got lucky or I just take care of my truck. But I've only regen three times, and I got my numbers together before I called you for my question. And I've only idled in 3 years 35 hours. I've got 410,000 miles. I got it with 80 miles. I haven't been down only 3 days because of my tranny. But I'm very proud of my fuel number, my fuel economy. You know, like I told Kevin on Sunday, my 30-day is 8.9, 60 days 8.8, 90 days like 8.5, and my daily average is just about up to 8.2. My question I'm calling is, and they said that you would know more about it. With this new thing that Lucas has out, I just want to buy another $30,000 before I have to replace my canister, my DEF one, get a new one put on. What do you know about this Lucas DPF deep clean? I don't want to drop $60 and it doesn't do anything, or what do you know about it?
I'm sorry, we have not tested that yet. I can't. I wish I could answer that question for you, but I really can't. We haven't used that product yet. I know Bruce is really friendly with the folks at Lucas. We could probably get some info for you, but I have not tried it yet. I have seen it on the shelves. I have.
Well, it just came out, and it's not to gain fuel mileage or anything like that. It's a DPF maintenance thing that Lucas came out with. I mean, I don't have no problems. I've been very blessed with my truck. I take care of my truck. And I just was curious about it before I went and dropped $60. But my truck doesn't, still great oil, great horsepower, great fuel economy. So I'm just saying, what the hell? I might as well just not bother with it. until I know more about it, because I don't like putting additives in my truck.
Did you say DPF or DEF?
No, it's the DEF additive. It's the Lucas DEF Deep Clean.
Well, if it does that, there is an issue with crystallization on these parts. So if they have come up with a product that could clean that off, that would be brilliant.
I'd like to see something that would melt that once it got hard.
Yep, we should order some in here and play with it. So
yeah.
Yep.
Like I said, $60 is $60 a thing, but if it can buy me another, because like I said, I'm going to be able to go $440,000 on this before I have to change my – I'm going to put a new one in. I'm not going to clean it. I'm just going to spend the $1,500 and put a new one on. I don't play that
just
game.
Just put a fresh one on it.
My next question, I'll get off the air. I just want to know Hold on a second, guys.
Hold on. I want to clarify something on this because I was totally confused the other day, and I'm trying to look it up right now. When you asked me this question the other day, Tad, I was thinking of their DPF cleaner, not DEF.
No, then that was my thing. But like I said, it runs $60 a bottle, and it's advertised all the time in the last 3 weeks. And that's what they say is supposed to clean your injectors, your DEF system, everything from engine, from tank to tailpipe.
Yeah, it's sold. It's called Diesel Deep Clean, and it's sold as a particulate filter cleaner. Yeah, DPF, the particulate filter, is what it's primarily designed to clean.
Okay.
And that goes in your fuel, I guess.
Right.
Do I need to stay away from it? Because I don't like putting additives in my fuel. So I just wondered if it was worth the money.
I told you the other day the same thing John did. I haven't tested it. I know it's out there. I've heard of it. If it worked, that would be wonderful, but I have no idea if it does or not.
But he had me kind of excited.
Would you like me to try
it? If they had something,
give you some feedback?
Well, you don't have a problem now anyway, so it'd probably be hard to tell to get any kind of quantity. Yeah, if I were you, I would keep doing what you're doing. That truck seems to be working great. You're getting terrific fuel mileage. You don't have issues.
My truck, when I pull a hill with 44,000, I drop one gear. It's just a phenomenal truck. Now, I need to know one thing. On the crankshaft damper, I'm looking at January. What kind of price tag am I looking at for you guys to do it for me?
And I'll let you think about
damper
that.
Damper and balancer.
Right when we get back from this break. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. This is the Power Hour. All right, a quick heads up. We're heading into the fourth segment here in the second hour, but I am going to come back and do a third hour of general questions. We might have some Pittsburgh Power questions left over. I'll try to get to those, but we're going to do an hour of general questions right after this, so don't hang up when we're done. We'll come back and do it again. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final hour, so we're going to get right back to the phone calls. This is the Power Hour. I've got John and Leroy with me from Pittsburgh Power, and we're answering your questions. So we're going to get right back to the phone calls. We are off to Washington. Charlie, welcome to the program.
Hello, guys. I'm the one with the D, ISX. You did the first one, I think.
Okay. Which one would that be?
The black G6.
Oh, Charlie. This is Charlie.
Yeah.
Isn't
it? Hi, Charlie. How are you?
I'm all right, I think.
Something.
Anyway.
And you weren't the first one. So.
You weren't my first.
Oh, anyway. Oh, stop.
We love you.
Anyway. The guy with it's running, the truck's running great. The guy with the temperature question, you just have to watch your pyrometer and your water temperature, and your oil's just about 20, 30 degrees warmer than that. But, like, I just pulled over the Continental Divide yesterday and just backed out of a little bit, and the pyrometer was at 10. I didn't let it go over that.
Right,
so,
and if you run it right up to 10, what does the oil temperature get to?
About 230.
Yeah, so that's not going to hurt anything. I don't have a problem. What point does it give you a warning? When does it start yelling at you?
I think 250. Is that what it's at?
The red line is above. It's above 250, but this is on a Kenworth. But anyway, I just wanted to tell you that part. And I have a donor truck. If you want to try experiment with your electric motor, and
oh yeah,
and. What are you guys getting a DPF? I'm up here and I can't go get the good loads in California from Oregon, so I'm kind of with my hands tied here.
I'm really trying on that, to be honest with you. I cannot find one at a reasonable price. And
okay.
Maybe I need to decide what the reasonable price is, but all the good ones that I find are somewhere in the $25,000 range to have installed.
Wow.
If you don't find Gary, let me know. That's when it's
all said
and done.
Yeah.
there is a data system that needs to go along with it to keep CARB happy. And there are some inexpensive ones out there, but I've heard some not so good things about them. So the really good stuff is there are two brands that I'm looking at, and they are, you know, when it's all said and done, you know, installed and everything, we're looking at, you know, somewhere 20 to 25 grand to have it done.
The really good ones is you buy another truck.
Parts alone are about 18. So yeah, that's where
so
I
hate
it.
Charlie,
yeah.
You've got to find a lot of really, really good paying California loads to make that thing worth it.
You're right. But so if I bought an ISX, I used ISX, you guys could kind of work with a DPF on it, right?
You got it. Yeah, we've got those things running terrific. The 2250 and 2350 ISXs, we've really got running well. And that's with everything in place. Everything looks good. It's, yeah. Yep.
I don't even know what mine is, but I think, did you find out if I can use a bigger turbo, Leroy?
I think yours is the 8519 CPL. I'd have to double check your engine serial number. I think I looked it up and wrote it down, but I don't have it off the top of my head.
You washed your hand off, didn't you? Okay.
I did.
Okay. All right, guys. I just wanted, you know, the guy just has to back out a little bit when it gets warm, that's all.
Other than that, running pretty good, though?
Sure. I mean,
Sure.
Well, that was my fault. I cut him off there. I was too quick on the button that time.
Oh, bye, Charlie.
I thought we were. Well, yeah, bye, Charlie. No, he said he's running great. So we'll go with that. Let's go to South Carolina. William, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
Good.
Just bought my first truck. I've been driving for 3 years. I got a 94 Freightliner Blacktop with an N14 Cummins in it. The only problem I've been noticing is that I'm test driving it, and it seems to be top speed 62 miles an hour. It has the Freightliner road relay screen on the dash, and it starts beeping. Seems that that's the fastest I can go. But I also don't have the right tire sizes all around the truck, so I'm wondering if it's a tire issue, an ECM issue, or if that's the top speed of the truck.
Well, it's not the top potential speed of the truck. It's probably just the way the ECM was set up. Leroy, you could answer what he could do with that N14.
Yeah, I mean, it's most likely what the ECM is programmed to, especially if it's throwing the lights off and stuff like that. The tires, incorrect tire size would probably, whether it's one way or the other, it could give you an unfair reading. So it probably just needs to be reprogrammed, that's all.
If it sees different speeds at different wheels, if he's got odd size tires on there, would that piss it off somehow?
That would upset the ABS system, not necessarily the engine.
Okay.
So the engine's going to limit the speed.
Is that the govern speed, or is that maybe just something that you guys can tune up for me?
Yeah, it's just the govern speed needs change, that's all.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
No problem.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Illinois. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Got a manifold pressure gauge. My turbo pressure gauge isn't working no more.
Oh, no.
And don't know if it's the gauge or I've got your scan gauge here, Kevin, but it doesn't read correctly. It's in a C15 there.
On some of the scan gauges, they read a different scale than PSI like we're used to seeing. But I guess the question is it a mechanical gauge or an electronic gauge? The one that's not working.
That's the mechanical gauge.
Yeah, and the line might have fell off or got cut or something.
Yep. Yeah, you have to just check the line, make sure the line's on. Is it one that we installed?
No, it came with the truck, at the factory.
Okay. Yeah, check your plumbing and check the fitting where it goes into the manifold. Sometimes those get a little gummed up.
Check the gauge, too.
And the gauge, too, yeah.
Might be that.
So if you pull pull the line off at the manifold there and just blow a little shop air into it gently because, you have a little more shop air than the gauge is capable of. But have someone look at it, blow on the end of it there with shop air and make sure it moves.
Okay. All right. And then if not,
and
if it does,
take a look at the fitting. They're a little 90-degree fitting sometimes. The fittings will sometimes get some carbon buildup in them. We just had one here the other day that was all plugged up.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'll give that a try.
All right. So, John, if you had somebody in the shop with a good set of lungs, they could probably just blow through it themselves, right?
It's hard. Yeah. Yeah. You're not capable of a
really good set.
Yeah. It's amazing. You can't blow it. Yeah. Much at all, believe it or not.
I knew a guy, he was a bodybuilder, 5'3", the guy was tiny, 5'3". What he used to do on stage is kind of a fun exhibition kind of thing. He used to take a hot water bottle, and he could blow them up until they exploded.
Wow.
That's how much force that has to take? That has nothing to do with trucking, but it's that physics thing again. All right, let's squeeze another one in. Michigan, John, it's your turn. John, are you with me?
No. You lost him with the
bodybuilder.
Hey,
guys, how you doing today?
Oh, there he is.
Oh, there he is. Oh.
Hey, I was calling because I have a newer truck with EF. And I have heard that you should be throwing some distilled water into the system to help keep it cleaned out. What do you guys think about that? Is it something that's going to be harmful, or is it something that's not necessary?
Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, that's just going to upset the system.
It's perfectly formulated as 68% deionized water, not distilled, it's deionized. And the other 33% is urea. So, yeah, you don't want to upset that balance at all. So just put straight DEF in it, that's all.
Okay. Well, when are you guys going to be 100% up and ready to go with the PACCAR motors?
Momentarily, we've got everything we need now. We have not ordered any tools yet. I just got the list of tools we need, but wasn't anything fancy there, and our local Kenworth dealer is ready to supply what we need. I wasn't going to do, we don't need a full pallet like they told Bruce about the Volvos. It's actually pretty simple stuff.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
good.
We've got a list. Actually, the service manager at the local Kenworth dealer is working with me to help out. He said he would get us a list of the stuffy things we actually need, but we've already got the the diagnostic software and so forth.
Software and, should be in today or tomorrow.
And that engine uses all the after-treatment and EGR coming, so we're already familiar with those systems. So the basics like overheads, damper balancers, manifolds, and EGR and after-treatment maintenance we could do right now.
Bring it on.
Perfect. There we go. John Leroy, thanks, guys. Great stuff, as always. Be safe, be profitable, fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rust.
All right, I said I might do a third hour, but I just looked at my schedule today, and I looked at the calls. We only have a couple, so instead of trying to get a bunch more calls, I'm going to call it a day, and we will see you back here tomorrow for general questions and Destination Health. Thanks. We'll see you then.